Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
Mike Cosentino is
and
right
we
here.
We have a guest in the studio today.
We do have a stellar guest in the studio today. This is a kind of a thrill. We got Jeff Biggers. I'm going to read a little bio here, folks. He's an award-winning star and a journalist and a playwright. We're going to talk about his plays. We're going to talk about his journalism. We're going to talk about his history. He's the author of The Forthcoming, of which we're going to talk a lot about today, Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. But we also want to talk to him about, he wrote a book, several of them. The United States of Appalachia was quite famous a while back, but he wrote one called Arizona and the Final Showdown over the American Dream. And it was selected as a top 10 book for in social sciences by Publishers Weekly. One of the other interesting titles he has is Eagle Creek, The Secret Legacy of Coal in the Heartland, winner of the Della Award for Literature, and lots of other stuff. The United States of Appalachia, as I mentioned, and in the Sierra Madre recipient for several magazine and travel book awards.
And we are going to talk about his new book, Resistance, which is being released tomorrow,
yep,
July 3rd, right in time for July 4th.
And he's big in a lot of my favorite publications, The Atlantic, The Huffington Post, that other radio show, what is it called, National Public Radio?
Forget those guys. Democracy something. Right?
And The Guardian.
Yeah, and The Guardian. All right, Jeff. Start by telling us about your new book, and we want to talk about some of the other stuff you've written, which really interests us. But you have a book called Resistance. It's coming out. It's not a long book, and it's filled with stories of resistance in American history, all kinds of different resistance by different people for different reasons. Let's define resistance. I know that seems sort of pedestrian, but let's define what is resistance. We're talking about political resistance.
Right. That's a great question. I'm very happy to be here. You know, I'm from Arizona, and my family lives in the area here, and I lived for many years in Flagstaff, and I grew up outside Tucson, so this is home country for me. And so when I think of resistance, I think of the birth even of the state of Arizona. I think a lot of people who've come here as snowbirds or folks who've moved here don't realize that our state was born a radical labor state. We had a governor who had been a former copper miner, a labor leader, who said, you know, the issue is that we have to fight against the 1%. He said this in 1916. And he said, we have to look back to the roots of our American Revolution, our resistance. And I thought about that a lot. About a year ago, my son came to me. He was 12 years old. And when President Trump pulled out of the climate accords, of course, the only nation in the entire world which refused to go along with the climate change accords, my 12-year-old son came to me and said, is there any hope? And I didn't want to give him a lecture about climate change and climate action and go recycle your bottle as if that was going to solve it. I wanted to go deeper. I wanted to go back to the American Revolution, to a period that was very dark, when we thought, you know, we weren't going to win the American Revolution, when all hope had been given up, when there was mutinies with George Washington. And these were my ancestors, I've had six of my eight branches came to the Americas by the 1650s and were very, very involved in the American Revolution. And they came up with this idea that resistance was a fundamental credo of who we are as Americans, that is, in fact, our greatest patriotic duty as we come up on July 4th, to defend our democracy against any kind of authoritarian spasms of anyone who has duplicitous civil authority and reckless authority and people who are trying to clamp down on our basic civil rights, be it immigration rights. You know, a fundamental part of our Declaration of Independence was the right to migrate. And we talked about travel bans in our Declaration of Independence. So all these things were part of who we were as Americans. And I wanted to tell this story to my 12-year-old son that ultimately, hopelessness adapts to our situation, but hope resists. And that is ultimately who we are as an Americans. Resistance is something we have to reclaim.
Excellent, excellent. Yes, you have Hope Resists is in the first chapter.
Let me be a devil's advocate right from the start, because I was raised in Oklahoma. Lots of Southerners immigrated up to Oklahoma. They saw the whole Civil War as a war of resistance to Northern stuff. The racists in Oklahoma who refused to serve black folks in their restaurants, they saw it as resistance to authority. And the militia groups in Arizona and other places see their activities as resistance too. So how do we define, how do we evaluate different kinds of resistance? You're talking about resistance, and you would say there were resistance against the fundamental American tradition, those.
Yeah, I think the key word here is our democracy. You know, our nation was not born merely to become a nation and then to crown the next king. What made us an unusual country, not an exceptional country, but an unusual country, is that we said we are going to seed a democracy. And therefore, resistance, by definition, is when that democracy is attacked from outside or from inside. We have to resist any kind of attack on our democracy. And so, sure, I think what you're asking is a very good question. You know, I covered the militias in 2010, went down to the border, and I've you know, covered stories across the nation of people who, you know, have these kind of rebellions. And I'm not talking simply about just, I don't want to pay my taxes. I'm talking about fundamentally, how do we defend the American democracy? Whereas these other rebellions outside, I see as lawless, as not being part of democracy. I see them as land grabs, as people who are outside the bounds of what we believe in democracy and what we believe in our Constitution. And so I think that's the difference, is fundamentally, when we see these kind of rebellions, are they really defending our democracy, or are they actually going outside the bounds of why we founded this democracy? You know, and therefore setting up a militia on the border and picking off individual immigrants who are coming across, that's not part of our democracy. That has absolutely no fundamental connection to who we are and what we have been and what our history is about. And so, sure, we can call it rebellion, but that's not American
resistance.
Well,
they would say they were defending American democracy. And this is, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, Trump's risen to power on stuff like this. Mm-hmm. You know, they may be evil, but he's risen to power. They would see resistance on the border to illegal immigrants, they call them, coming into the United States as a protection of democracy and protection of the American thing. So what do you have to say to them? You've covered them. You've talked to them. You know what they think.
All right. First off, 99.99% of the people who have been down on the border are not from Arizona. They're from other places, and they have all come in, and that, for, to me, is the greatest irony. As someone who grew up in Arizona, as an immigrant, I came from the coal fields of southern Illinois, and we moved, and I was a little hillbilly kid dumped into the body of Tucson, and then we moved outside to the outskirts of Tucson. And I grew up with all these kids who came from Indiana and from Buffalo and from California. You know, we moved to Arizona the same year Jan Brewer, as an immigrant, came from California, and as everybody immigrated. And I grew up with kids who, in fact, had been here for centuries. People of a Mexican-American identity who said, hey, we didn't cross the border crossed us. And I'll never forget, when I was a little kid in fifth grade, because I have red hair, they said, hey, you know, howdy doody, you go on the local TV station and talk about Arizona history. And there was an indigenous native kid from Tucson, from the Altham, who talked about the amazing history of the Altham, who now are divided by a border. They didn't cross a border. And then there was an incredible Chicano, a Mexican-American student, who talked about their history. He didn't cross any border. The border crossed him, of course, after the Mexican-American War, and we took Arizona. And then came my turn. And I had to really look at them and say, you know, I'm the immigrant. You know, if anybody in this room is an immigrant, it's me. And it's fundamentally required for me to understand my history of migration. So then we bring that to the border today, where you have these people who are from outside, who come down from Washington and Idaho and Montana and Indiana and Iowa, and they so-called want to protect a border they don't even understand the history from. And then we don't even really look at the facts that, in fact, we have a net migration of people coming across the border now from Mexico. And that is something fundamentally we have to understand and look at the facts, that the migration that we often talk about with the millions of people who are undocumented who support our economy and keep our economies going, those people came in the 1990s. Those people came, of course, after many different changes in the economy and, of course, with NAFTA. And the people who are trickling across today are coming from incredibly intense situations in Central America. The large majority of the migrants are coming are from Guatemala, are coming from Honduras and El Salvador, where they have really a legitimate request under the Immigration Act to ask for asylum or some sort of protection. So we have to really understand why people are coming to this country, just why your ancestors came from Calabria in Italy, you know, on the same boat as Joe Arpaio, of course. He was a... You know, I think we often forget that Arpaio was a...
Upstate New Yorker, right?
Yeah, from Massachusetts.
From Massachusetts.
You know, whose family came in just under the Immigration Act of 1924, when people from southern Italy, like your heritage, were cut off. And we've gone through these spasms throughout our entire history. And that's what I'm trying to say is, let's really look at our fundamental history and how we have learned from these mistakes. It's very important. The First Lady... You have to give her credit.
Yes.
Came to Arizona a couple of days ago to look at the immigration camps. And I was reminded of our history in 1943 when another First Lady came to Arizona. Eleanor Roosevelt came in 1943 and she went to outside the Gila Indian Reservation to see the Japanese internment camps. And she says, we can never undo the mistakes of history. And she called for the Japanese internment camps to be closed, that we are one people, that we don't distinguish between race and religion. And I think that's the kind of leadership from the First Ladies that we really have to recognize, is that from day one we've had these mistakes on our immigration and other things, and the beauty of our American democracy is how we work for a better country.
You have a chapter called One of the Reasons for Resistance is to Undo Mistakes, I believe.
Right.
Chapter 4. It starts with, and as you do a lot of it, a lot of your book deals with, and we're talking about, Jeff Biggers here this morning, about resistance, reclaiming an American tradition. Is the name of the book. It's coming out tomorrow. A lot of Thomas Paine, by the way, if you're a Thomas Paine fan, which we did a little research before, and there's not a lot of, not a lot of memories or memorials to Thomas Paine in the United States.
I did find one which the Thomas Paine Society gave to England, which I think is a kind of ironic thing. Here's a statue of a guy who led the resistance to you guys.
I'm going to take this a little bit of a different direction. I'm looking at your book here, well, at least a few pages from it. You got a quote from Thomas Paine. Yeah, now you talked about your conversation with your son about when America pulled out of the climate accords, the only nation to do so. And you were in jail at the time for resistance, if I'm not mistaken.
I had been in jail many years beforehand on a different protest.
I see.
And so I wanted to tell my son about being in jail in a different period when we were talking about civil rights. And in my jail cell, I was a very young man, and we had been protesting the denial of basic civil rights. And the cellmate was an old preacher who basically said he had learned from the civil rights movement in the South. He had been one of the first freedom riders in Alabama.
Reverend Sloan Coffin.
Reverend William Sloan Coffin, Reverend Sloan in Doonesbury. And he basically said, you know, as he jested on that cement seat in jail, he said, hey, you know, once again, he told me this wonderful phrase that hopelessness adapts and we throw in the towel. And it's hope that resists. And that's what he learned from these young African-Americans who really changed, you know, the South and what we have today and really inspired us. And I think who really brought on this great tradition we have today.
I just like that origin story, and that's why I wanted to go back to it. You also talk about, early in the book, a quote from Thomas Paine, the philosophy, and this was kind of a good idea, getting back to more middle-of-the-road stuff like Steve. You and I, of course, are firebrands, and we will have no quarter with the enemy, or at least those people that choose to restrict the freedoms long and hard fought for in the U.S. But the quote I want to talk about in your book from Thomas Paine says, the philosopher of one country sees not an enemy in the philosopher of another. He takes his seat in the temple of science and asks him who sits beside him. The idea being Paine was, I guess, trying to encourage negotiations with England and that they could sit down and talk things out rather than go to war, rather than take up arms.
And also something I think very, very much lost in the rise of nationalisms everywhere in Europe, in the U.S., and the third world, was the feeling that there were cross-national connections between people, that philosophers from one country are not enemies of philosophers of another. A painter in one country is not the enemy. A businessman in one country is not the enemy of a businessman in another country. And this feeling that there was a deeper international connection of human beings around the world, we seem to be in a period, Jeff, where that's in abeyance or being questioned, and there's this rise of all these angry nationalisms.
Right. I think that's a great point. Thomas Paine gave us our name. He's the person who wrote the United States of America, and yet he's the most unknown person of all of our revolutionary forefathers. There's 7,000 monuments to the Confederates, including three in Arizona, and we weren't even a territory then. And yet there's not one single monument to Thomas Paine in Washington. Here's the man who determined whether we were Americans or not, that in our darkest hour, when once again we were having secret negotiations to give the North to the Americans and the South to the British, and just think what that would have done to our country music scene. Here was Tom Paine, who was actually saying, no, we can fight this and we can win it, that we may not have the numbers, but we have the unity, that we have to take on the brutish leadership of someone who's trying to wreak havoc in mankind, who doesn't understand democracy. And he gave us and galvanized us, you know, and he wrote this thing called Common Sense. It was a pamphlet. And this was before July 4th, 1776. It came out in January, when everybody else was afraid, when the Continental Congress actually wrote a letter of reconciliation. It was called the Olive Branch or Olive Leaf Declaration, saying, hey, excuse me, Britain, but, you know, we kind of would like to be independent. But if that's going to bother you, that's okay. We won't do it. And Tom Paine.
Sounds like Democrats.
Right. And Tom Paine came in and said, have a backbone. And the resistance gave a backbone to democracy, and it gave a backbone to America. And he wrote Common Sense saying, now is the time for us to seek our independence, because this is really who we are, and we're trying to create this American democracy. And it galvanized the country. It was the biggest, and still today, it's the most read document ever published in the United States. Over 100,000 copies were published and circulated in 1776. You know, that's 100,000 more than my books will ever sell. and Thomas Paine changed us with these words, galvanizing us on who we were. And here was an immigrant. Once again, it's an immigrant who really gave us the sense of the quintessential American. And George Washington couldn't believe it. Suddenly his troops were reading Common Sense, and in the field he wrote a letter saying, this is turning the tide of the American Revolution. And then Thomas Paine put down his pen, he picked up a bayonet and a musket, and he walked to the front lines, and he was with Washington. They asked him, once again, to keep writing. And so in a period of 1776 into 1777, you know, the revolution went bad.
Yeah.
And I think often when people think, you know, we had July 4th, 1776, and then the next day we went shopping at the mall. And it didn't go that way. The revolution went on for years, and it really went poorly. We really were going to lose the revolution. You know, at a certain point we reached a stalemate, and then there was a southern strategy, and the Brits went down, and they took Savannah, Georgia, and they took Charleston, and they were just rolling up the Carolinas. And people were terrified. And Thomas Paine goes back to Philadelphia, and he begins to write. And he says, these are the times that try our souls. And this is the time when, you know, either you're going to be a sunshine patriot or you're going to stand for your nation. And he wrote this incredible document. And George Washington had that read to his troops around the campfires, who then crossed the Delaware and went in and reclaimed New York. And began, this really changed our American Revolution, the writings of these kind of people. And this went on for the whole extent of the American Revolution, the role of writers, the role of people and immigrants like Thomas Paine, who really defined who we are.
We need them no less now. We need the Jeff Biggers. We're listening to Jeff Biggers, author of Resistance and Reclaiming an American Tradition. As you can hear, he believes it certainly is an American tradition. But I'm talking about the tradition of Michael Moore. Maybe we tell our stories now. We tell our Thomas Paine stories through movies, through video. the Young Turks, all sorts of new media organizations online. There's lots of truth out there, and there's lots of resistance out there. And one of the, if nothing else in this 45 minutes, that resistance is hope. And when so much of it is hopeless, when we see the 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 things that he who should not be named in the White House, it does these stupid, cruel, mean, democracy-robbing, constitution-in-the-face-of-denying things that wears you down. It makes you hopeless. And I hear that. That's the most common thing I hear every day. I walk down the street. I'm the political guy, so I get all the political stuff. You're the political writer. I'm sure you get the same thing. And people will come to you just how angry they are, how hopeless they are, how tired they are.
I had a woman I was talking to. She said, "I really liked the interview you did with Nancy McLean." She said, "But it was too scary. I had to turn it off." Mm. So I think a lot of people are turning off to politics because the situation looks so bad. You have Republicans, this strange new Republican Party. It's very different from the old one.
It's a criminal organization.
Yeah, controlling everything. And you have a spread of the oligarchs. You have a Supreme Court that represents the wealthy now almost, and the oligarchs. You have a Congress. You have all this purchasing of America by the super wealthy. And you have, you know, they can put in $5 million and you can put in $100. I think a lot of people are Mike's talking about. They're in despair that anything can be done about this giant machine and this encroachment against our democracy by a kind of oligarchy that's spreading in our country.
Let me mention this, Jeff. Jeff, we're talking to Jeff Biggers. Go out and buy six of his books. But Terry Goddard, another Arizonan, good Democrat, started a movement called Outlaw Dirty Money. You talk about people coming from other countries, excuse me, at least other places, to be on our border. We're talking about money coming from other places, including other countries, but certainly other states, to control our politics. So Goddard proposed a simple constitutional amendment that if you give, and I'm obviously simplifying here, if an individual gives more than $2,500, we want your name and address. Organization gives more than $10,000, we want to know who's in your organization. That's simple. That's the Arizona constitutional amendment. I was in Prescott the other day trying to get signatures on those petitions. I was afraid. I was with a couple of young people trying to register voters for NextGen, the Tom Strayer organization. They were physically afraid. The crowd was that. This is a rodeo parade, by the way. I'm not sure why it's important, but they have the world's oldest rodeo. Why an old rodeo is more important than a young one, I'm not
old
sure.
Old rodeos are very
well,
important.
There you go.
But what's your message? I mean, because, I mean, we do hear a lot. It's not
I hear a lot
of people turning off to politics because the situation looks so bad. That's kind of what I would like to know. What's your message to people who are getting really, really upset? And Mike's right. There's, you know, the militia groups and a lot of those people are fairly scary. And we didn't know what would happen if Hillary Clinton had won.
Right. We'll try to loop in both questions because I think they're really very, very important. You know, and I really appreciate going to Prescott. To me, it's very easy to go collect petitions in San Francisco or New York City or West Side Chicago. It's another thing to do what you folks do, which is to be in rural Arizona. And my role as a writer, as a historian, and as a journalist has always been to go to the other America, to rural Arizona, to go to the rural South, where I've been based for years, and to go across the country and to say there's a progressive tradition here which we really need to recognize, and we don't need to be afraid because this is our country. This is my land. When I was booked to come into this radio station, and she said, would you mind going to an AM radio station in rural Arizona? And I said, of course, this is my people. These are the people I love talking to, because this is we come out of. 2 days ago, I published a story on Huffington Post that is very relevant to what you're saying. I said, Arizona has already dealt with everything that Trump is trying to introduce. You know, Arizona was Trump before Trump.
That's right.
Trump, in fact, is using the Arizona immigration playbook page by page. But here's the story the national media doesn't know, is that there was a sizable resistance in Arizona that fought back, and they won many very, very important victories. So just look at them, and this is the kind of thing that should really galvanize you to be able to go out there and say, hey, this is my country. You know, when Trump got elected in 2016, a very concerted organizing went on, and we took down Sheriff Joe Arpaio, someone who we thought we could never defeat in Maricopa County. But it was because of grassroots organizations who organized, they actually defeated Arpaio in Maricopa County, in the same county that voted for Trump.
We had Paul Panzone on the show, by the way.
Right. And the immediate thing they did was close down the tent camps, which had been denounced for 24 years as a violation of human rights, you know, and was just a spectacle, part
Paul
of
Panzone
the circus
Maximus. His replacement.
Right.
So,
and what, let me keep going.
Yeah.
And
yep.
So we tend to forget that when Russell Pierce pushed through SB 1070, the self-proclaimed Tea Party president, he seemed untouchable. He was a state senate president, someone who was incredibly important in America, and a small group of organizers in Mesa and Mormons and rural folks said, hey, this is not who we are. And they began to organize against him in 2011. And for the first time in American history, we had a recall of a state senate president, and we brought down Pierce within 1 year.
I was in LD18, by the way, getting petition signatures.
Right. That was an amazing,
then too.
Amazing story. You know, and Randy Potter should go into the Hall of Fame of Arizona.
Randy Perez has been on the show.
Yeah, he's been on the show. We talked to him right after, and he was so surprised when a bunch of Mormons came to his legal aid.
Yeah.
They showed up, and he was in court, and they said, your lawyer's here. And he said, I don't have a lawyer. And they said, oh, yes, you do. And these guys showed up. They were pissed at the way Arpaio was acting.
Right. And Pierce, and let's just keep going. We can keep going down the list of Arizonans. Once again, if you are an Arizonan, learn your Arizona history, that we came in with the most progressive constitution, you know, 100 years ago. Mother Jones, you know, the great immigrant labor activist, came out and along with William Jennings Bryan, and they said, hey, Arizona is in the forefront of the nation as the most progressive state. And that's why we became a state, is because of our great copper mine. And that was really a Mexican laborers who brought in this incredible constitution. You know, once again, we, you know, it came back 7 years ago, and they had this ridiculous idea of banning Mexican-American studies. And in Tucson, you had a district that was 65% Mexican-American who just simply wanted to learn their history.
Yeah.
That the Tucson Unified School District was founded by a Mexican-American. That public education was founded by Mexican-Americans. That it was a Mexican-American immigrant who defied the handful of Yehu Confederates who tried to hijack our little tiny territory in that period. And they actually were able to shut down Mexican-American studies. But for 7 years, people fought it. And just a few months ago, the appellate court threw it out, and Arizona won again. So once again, if we keep going down, we can realize that Arizonans have fought back, and the nation can learn from the incredible work of people like you going and collecting signatures in Prescott. And the final story we have to really think about, especially for you newcomers who've come here in the last, let's say, 50 years. I'd say anybody
who hasn't been. Everybody in Sedona.
If you haven't been in Arizona in 50 years, you're an immigrant to me. Is that 30 years ago, we had a governor who had a very similar kind of spectacle as our president today, someone who had been connected to the John Birch Society, someone who was an extremist, who had been a used car salesman, who had run 5 times for governor, who just because of a fluke in the Republican Party, he was able to get the nomination, and another fluke of dividing the ballot, he became our governor. And the first thing Evan Meekin did, of course, was rescind the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, and he had one gaffe after another. We had an extraordinary recall campaign once again. And then, of course, eventually, Ev Meekham was impeached.
Yeah.
And that was 30 years ago that we, Arizona, impeached a governor who totally embarrassed the nation because of his extremism. So once again, the nation can learn from your amazing efforts. And that's why I love being an Arizonan, because we have these incredible, this incredible
history. His campaign aide was from Prescott. Sam Steiger was from Prescott, by the way. He's the, and he was a resistor before he became a toady for Evan Meekham.
Sedona and the surrounding area is filled with resistance groups against the Trump administration in the direction. Now. Yeah, right now. Mm-hmm. And there are all these different groups. What strategy of resistance? Do you have something that you would recommend to people who are striving to figure out how to oppose what's happening, not only Trump, but basically the culture of corruption that's being spread over the government? Do you have advice for how to do that more effectively, or what do you think the focus should be?
Right. Well, first off, there's many layers of resistance. I think often we think it's just protesting and getting out into the street, which is very important. I think another major avenue for resistance right now is going into the courts. That everything that happens that in fact is a violation of our Constitution needs to be challenged. And I think there the role of the ACLU and many other legal groups and community groups has been very important. I think what concerns me is over 80 important, incredibly important environmental regulations have been rolled back. I come from coal mining people, and I understand. Still today, 3 coal miners die daily from black lung disease. Which is unimaginable. You know, think about it. The electricity for most of Sedona is coming from a coal fire plant, and which seems ridiculous in the year 2018. And so I think part of what we can do in our resistance is going back to Tom Paine. Tom Paine said resistance was not just a protest, but it was an act of renewal, that we have it in our power to reinvent the world. And that's what it means to be an American. And I think if we take that motto today, it means that Sedona could become the model a community for the nation if it said, hey, within, 5 years, we're going to be 100% renewable energy, that we're going to put solar because it's just a no-brainer. My parents have solar on their house, and they produce, over 100% of the electricity. Their AC is running with solar and all their needs. And this is the kind of resistance also I think we have to be talking about, is how, as people in Sedona, can we become a model regenerative community, a community that regenerates all the resources it uses. There's no reason we can't, instead of you import 95% of your food in this town.
Yeah.
And there's no reason in this Verde Valley we can't create a local food economy that supports more jobs, healthier food, and a local infrastructure. There's no reason we can't begin to look at our energy, to our water, to every part of our life, our transportation, as an independent, self-sufficient Sedona, that in fact the true resistance is that we have a thriving community that's self-sufficient and also will work to work for climate action.
Jeff Biggers, we just spent a few hours in a room over at Starbucks with some people that felt supporters of the show that felt exactly the same way. I mean, you are certainly speaking to their souls as you talk right now. We're talking to Jeff Biggers, author of Resistance, an American Tradition. And yes, we had a little sort of informal discussion of city council and who's running for it, and the possibility of national positions that city councils can take. So it's just
So there's so many groups now and so many discussions about what to do and what to emphasize. And I think that Mike and I have felt that it's sort of all good, from street protests to getting out and registering to vote to learning about local issues to actually running for office. Mm-hmm. I mean, the courage now to run for office is important. I mean, people in Arizona, particularly on the progressive side, are burned after losing contest after contest. It's very hard to recruit candidates. We have good candidates for state offices now. And I think there's so many different kinds of things to do. I don't think there's one answer. But I think that you're right. I think the important thing is layers of resistance by different people doing different things and different focuses. How this all comes together, maybe you know. I don't know.
Well, I think ultimately we have to take on the threat today. And I think that threat is an administration that is reckless, that is in fact going through this authoritarian spasms that are unconstitutional, that, as you say, is catering to the 1%. And I think we've seen that with the tax cut going, you know, once again, these are facts, a tax cut that's going largely to the ultra rich and not to the rest of America, to our economic policies and whatnot. I think these ultimately are the kind of threats to our democracy that we have to take on. So certainly getting people to vote and turn out local candidates is crucial. I mean, we have the numbers in Arizona, for example, to change the system here, no different than many other states. It's a matter of just mobilizing people to vote. You know, when our nation was founded, it was just a handful of old white guys who were wealthy who were allowed to vote. You know, none of my ancestors could vote even though they fought the American Revolution because they weren't landowners. You know, they were just peons who were foot sloggers, you know, and basically border fighters. My people had trickled into North Carolina and to the Appalachians, and they're the ones who actually fought the American Revolution, but they didn't have anything. You know, and I think that's what we realized was how do we make sure our democracy is for all people? And now that we have the chance to have our elections, we've really got to mobilize and make sure everybody votes. It's incredible when we have these elections, you know, we have such low turnouts. In my town where I'm living in Iowa now, it's a university town, we had our mayor and city council election, and less than 14% of the people in a college town voted. You know,
that was true in the, I think the last Sedona election, it was about 20% of the people voted.
Yeah, and I think that's where we have to really tell people is, hey, once again, if you're part of our community, you know, this is something we've fought and died for. And it's not literally just a kind of a cliche we throw out there, that I think what we're finally seeing today is these elections have consequences.
That's right.
And they have severe consequences. And so if anything, and I think if anything, we can thank the current occupant of the White House, is he's waking people up to realize, wow, there is an incredible consequence for not being part of the democratic experience.
Well, then there is that, too. I mean, and that doesn't, because of the way politics works, that the Democrats fight among themselves as much as and weaken that resistance to a point where it can become ineffective. That the deal making that Donald Trump has is valuable to the Democratic Party, because you have these two organizations. So he's valuable to the Democratic Party as a symbol of what you know. So in the beginning, anyway, to keep him in office meant a recruiter for the left. He was the number. I had a school superintendent that was not a nice person. We had 100% in our union that year when I was president. That was the only year we. And I thanked him on his way out, by the way, for you know doing my job for me. But the point is, there is that aspect of it that when it gets that bad, then we get the next gen. We get, I'm standing next to 22-year-olds.
If you've ever worked in a business with a crazy, out-of-control boss, you understand how people in Washington feel about the Trump administration. Mm. The guy's out of control. He's crazy. But beneath that, and I think Mike would agree with me on this, beneath that is a Republican Party that's become very, very different than the Republican Party we knew. Still has the same name, but the values have degenerated and migrated into something very strange. And I think that's the problem is not just Trump, but the 90% of Republicans, people who call themselves Republicans, who support what he's doing.
Can you explain why the Republican House is not investigating anything? We're talking about blatant corruption. We're talking about Constitution ignorance. Please.
You know, I wish I knew, and I think that's the great mystery, and I think ultimately they're going to pay a price for it by losing in the elections coming up. I think we have to look at the reality of the role of dirty money and lobbies today in our elections, and these people are very afraid. I think we've all saw a couple of weeks ago an ad of a veteran who's running for Congress in Texas in the Democratic Party. She was a helicopter pilot who was shot down in combat in Afghanistan and disabled. She comes back to Texas, and she was trying to get better benefits because she felt the VA was not helping her and helping her former comrades in the military. And her congressman wouldn't talk to her. Literally, the assistant said, have you donated to his campaign? And she said, no, I'm a constituent. I donated my body in combat. And they wouldn't talk to her because of these kind of dirty money connections. Yeah. And therefore, she said, hey, the only way I can get him to wake up is I'm going to run for Congress. And clearly, she's in the forefront now.
That's that YouTube ad that's
right.
just gone viral all over.
Right. Yes.
Gotten,
I
don't know, a million views
right.
or something.
And yeah. it was amazing. And I think this is the story that's waking people up, is that we have this so-called Republican Congress that is so caught up in the dirty money, who are so afraid to go against the lobbies. And I think we've seen that with coal and oil and in many different respects, that they're not standing up for who we are, really, in Americans.
Well, let's talk about Democrats for a minute, the last 5 minutes. You know, and because certainly this is what I get from my younger progressive folks, even in Cottonwood. There's a few. You know, and they start listing all the crimes of the other side. We only got two choices. Maybe then that's part of the problem, but that's not going to be changed anytime soon. So you got, you know, you got vanilla and you got chocolate. And that's, so what, you have these corporate Democrats, certainly represented by the Hillary wing, you know, Clinton was the best Republican president we ever elected, you know, to some of us. And so we got this whole thing going on. How can we get philosophers to talk to each other so they don't destroy each other?
Right. Definitely infighting. I think one day I want to write a book on infighting just within social movements, how so many amazing movements, you know, throughout history. And I think this is why we don't know who Thomas Paine is. He was part of the infighting. And in the end, he was nixed from the American history books because of the infighting.
I see.
I think it has to be local. I'll never forget, I interviewed once a very important agricultural leader, and he said, whenever we need a microphone, I think we've lost the concept of democracy, because we've lost being in a room where we all can hear each other. And I think it's true. I think if you look at Vermont and ask, why did Bernie Sanders come out of a place like Vermont? You know, here's a state that ultimately is rural, that it historically was conservative. And how did a Bernie Sanders come out of there and become their senator? I think we have to look at the history, that once again, Bernie was on the city council, and then he became the mayor, and then he became a congressman, and then he became a senator. And I think that's what we need to understand, is once again, if Sedona could turn the tide and have a progressive city council and then put itself on the map like Boulder and so many other little small communities, to say, hey, we're going to have an 85% zero waste policy. It's not just you guys have an extraordinary recycling community here, but we're going to take it and we're going to make it in terms of, you know, all facets of what we use in terms of our waste and our energy and our food and our transportation and how we do sustainable tourism. And if the local politics changed, then it begins to change regionally, and then it changes in the state, and then ultimately it happens in the whole Southwest. So ultimately it comes down to all politics is local, and that's how I think we're going to affect the resistance and the revolution here.
Well, that's Jeff Biggers we're talking to, and we hear that all the time. All politics is local. You just explained how it can be local.
His new book is coming out tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Yep.
Called?
Resistance, an American Tradition. And certainly, you know, when my Facebook page yesterday gets a picture of a young local playwright with her Statue of Liberty paper torch, when she's going out here to 89A and Coffee Pot and going to do a little mini protest, a little grassroots, instant, spontaneous protest in support of the June 30th, by the way. Hopefully we'll start seeing more of that. The June 30th protest about keeping families together. There was thousands, tens of thousands that turned out in America, and we're not seeing a lot on corporate media.
Jeff is doing a reading of his book shortly.
Yes, where?
Friday at the library at 3.
Friday at the library at 3. All right, I'll be there.
Sedona Library,
yep.
3 o'clock on Friday. You can hear, you're going to read excerpts of the book,
yep,
and talk
and
about it.
I actually perform it in a theatrical monologues, and so I try to make it entertaining and interesting.
Kate Hawks, did you hear that? All right, we have, don't forget, we have, this is called Democratic Perspective. We have this show and all our shows available on podcast on VBID.org, folks. VBID.org has this show and all our shows. Thank you.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.